This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, on her first foreign trip as vice president, is looking to deepen diplomatic ties with Guatemala and Mexico, two Latin American nations key to the Biden administration's efforts to stem the spike in migration at the U.S. border. Harris, who departed Washington Sunday after a delay caused by a technical issue on Air Force Two, is seeking to secure a commitment for greater cooperation on border security and economic investment, but corruption in the region, a far more intractable challenge, will complicate her efforts. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will use the Group of Seven Wealthy Democracies summit this week to urge world leaders to commit to vaccinating the global population by the end of 2022. Johnson is expected to stress the importance of a global vaccination drive when he meets with fellow world leaders on Friday in Cornwall, southwestern England, for the first face-to-face G7 summit since the pandemic hit. The 3 days of talks will focus on the global recovery from the pandemic. Britain's government pledged in February to give most of the country's surplus vaccine supply to COVAX, the United Nations-backed program, aiming to supply poorer countries with jabs, but the UK has not yet put a figure on how many doses it will donate. Pope Francis expressed pain over the discovery in Canada of the remains of 215 residential school students and urged church and political authorities to work together to shed light on the shocking development. But he did not offer the apology sought by the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Francis on Sunday called on political and church authorities to shed the light on what happened and foster the healing. From the 19th century until the 1970s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend state-funded Christian schools. This is VOA News. Israel's far-right politician Naftali Bennett, who is set to replace Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister, called on him Sunday evening to let go, after Netanyahu said the newly formed Israeli coalition was a result of the greatest election fraud in the history of democracy. Bennett called on Israel's longest-serving leader not to leave scorched earth behind and accept that people are allowed to establish a government even if he doesn't want to head it. Netanyahu made his sweeping accusation of a time when Israel's domestic security chief has warned publicly about the prospect of political violence and focused his allegations on a broken campaign promise from Bennett, who pledged not to partner with left-wing centrist and Arab parties. On Wednesday, Bennett announced with opposition leader Yair Lapid that they had formed a governing coalition with factions from across the political spectrum in the wake of an inconclusive March 23rd election, Israel's fourth in 2 years. Mexicans went to the polls Sunday to elect the entire lower house of Congress, almost half the country's governors and most mayors, in a vote that will determine whether President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's party gets the legislative majority it needs to continue his fourth transformation of Mexico. López Obrador's critics have depicted the elections as a chance to stop the still popular president from concentrating more power and weakening checks and balances. The president says the opposition is dominated by conservatives who's opposed his campaign against corruption and wasteful spending. A well-known Russian opposition politician who was held in police custody for 2 days last week in a criminal investigation says he's left the country for Ukraine. Dmitry Gudkov said in a Facebook post Sunday that sources in Kremlin circles had told him that if he didn't leave the country, the fake criminal case will continue until his arrest. Gudkov says he believes the investigation is aimed at preventing him from running for the national parliament this year. He was a parliament member from 2011 to 2016. He was detained in connection with an investigation into money allegedly owed to the city for rental of office space. He was released without charges Thursday. His attention came as authorities continue to crack down on dissent ahead of September's parliamentary elections. More at voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Monday, June 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. In Uganda, the government has reinstated a partial lockdown, including suspension of schools, a ban on public gatherings, including places of worship and public transport.
All schools and institutions of higher learning to close for 42 days.
That is Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. And for more than 6 months, fighting has engulfed Ethiopia's Tigray region. Our correspondent is traveling through the region and gives us an update on the situation. The U.S. and the European Union are calling on the government of Nigeria to reverse its decision to indefinitely ban Twitter after the social media giant deleted a tweet from the president's account for violating its rules. But what is really behind this ban?
Social media proved very, very influential during the ENSAS movement in the latter part of 2020, and the government did pay extra attention to the power of social media and what people are able to do with it.
That is Nigerian writer and social commentator Japheth J.J. Omojua. The World Health Organization says foodborne pathogens are responsible for at least 137,000 deaths and 91 million acute illnesses in Africa every year. Those stories plus sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. For our top story, let's start off in Uganda, where the government has reinstated a partial lockdown, including suspension of schools, a ban on public gatherings, including places of worship and public transport. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni says that the new lockdown is aimed at preventing further spread of the new wave of COVID-19 variants that he says are even more deadlier. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
In a televised address to the nation Sunday evening, President Yoweri Museveni announced the new measures and said it was important to act as the number of people testing positive to COVID-19 will on rise, especially in the capital Kampala and the neighboring Wakesa district. President Museveni said the country now has the mutated versions of coronavirus first identified in South Africa, Nigeria, India and the UK, which he said are deadlier to the young population.
The government has revised the control measures to address the current situation as follows. All schools and institutions of higher learning to close for 42 days, effective 8 a.m., 7th of June, 2021. We debated this issue very seriously, because there was a debate that, if they go home, these children are not going to infect their people. Yes, that risk, but the risk of staying together, the risk of staying together is bigger than the risk of dispersal.
The president also suspended public gatherings, including places of worship.
Communal prayers in mosques, churches, or stadia, and other open-air venues are suspended for 42 days. Online prayers are encouraged. Public and cultural gatherings or conferences, except for the sitting of the cabinet, the legislature and judiciary, are hereby suspended for 42 days.
Social gatherings like weddings or burials will be restricted to not more than 20 people. The president also suspended inter-district movements and operation of open markets. The new measures are in addition to the existing ones, including curfew, which starts at 9 p.m. and ends at 5 a.m., plus places of entertainment like cinemas and bars that were closed when the first lockdown was announced in March 2020. Sports activities, however, are allowed to continue without spectators, but players are subjected to take regular COVID-19 tests. Harold Kaija, the Deputy Secretary General of Opposition Party Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, criticized the new lockdown. He said the government should rather concentrate on improving infrastructure, such as building and equipping hospitals to manage the rising cases.
It tells you of the collapse of infrastructure and systems in this country that has led to this. Otherwise, if we had actually prepared well, had schools, be able to reduce the cost of water, cost of electricity, cost of internet, because now you are sending kids to go back home and study, but the internet is high. They can't sit on Zoom watching TV. They promised us radios, TVs of the villages. That money was eaten. So in a nutshell, if you look so well, it is actually the poor who are being affected.
At least 51,000 people have tested positive for COVID-19 in Uganda. The president also talked about security issues following the attempted assassination of a senior government official, General Katumba Wamala, last week, in which his daughter and driver were killed. He said the government will provide a detailed report on previous cases of gun murders inflicted on senior government officials. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
For more than 6 months, fighting has engulfed Ethiopia's Tigray region. VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdock is traveling through the region and tells International Edition's Steve Miller that the people in the thick of the fighting are so angry that they can barely...
A lot of the anger is directed at the Ethiopian government forces and specifically the Eritrean forces. But one of the points of contention with the Ethiopian government forces, or at least the Ethiopian government, is that it allows Eritrean forces to be in their country. They see the Eritrean forces as threatening, and there's lots of stories of abuses. And while the stories about the Ethiopian government forces, there's also terrible stories about them, and as well as every other group involved in this battle. But on the ground, what we hear every day is anger directed towards the Eritrean forces and blaming the Ethiopian forces for allowing them to be there.
What's the humanitarian situation in the places that you're visiting? The United Nations estimated that some 90% of the people in Tigray are in dire need of food. When we were speaking earlier and you were in the capital city of Mekele, you know, you visited internally displaced persons camp, and people there hadn't eaten until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. What's it like out in the more remote areas?
There's food insecurity everywhere, and there's hunger everywhere. And in the more remote areas, people say that they do need food aid, and there's simply none available. The worst two areas that the United Nations is concerned about famine coming are largely cut off for reporters and humanitarian workers that can't get aid to them if they have it available. Another humanitarian crisis that's going on is in health, and it's quite dramatic, where healthcare centers, small clinics across the region, have been closed and many have been looted. In fact, most have been looted, if I can say, and they don't have any medicine and they don't have any equipment. And so I was in the hospital the other day, and we were meeting children without limbs, with gunshot wounds, and hit by shrapnel and terrible direct injuries from war. And many of them had spent weeks between the time they got injured to the time they got treated, because their parents were taking them from town to town trying to find help. But all the clinics had no supplies and no medicine. So like a baby whose leg was slashed with a knife and had a gunshot wound, sorry, she's 4 years old, a gunshot wound in her hand. It took her father weeks to bring her to the actual hospital, and they thought she was dead by the time she got there, because the only thing anyone had done in that time was just wash her with water. And these children that I'm talking about are the survivors.
That was VOA's Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdock. She was speaking to VOA's Steve Miller. In Nigeria, outcry continues over the decision by the government to suspend Twitter, the popular social media platform used by millions of people in Africa's most populous nation. The Buhari administration has ordered prosecutors to arrest and prosecute users of the Twitter app after a ban took effect. The U.S. and the European Union are joining a chorus of voices calling for the reversal of this highly controversial ban, which came a day after the social media giant deleted a tweet from President Buhari's account for violating its rules. The platform, which is used by at least 39 million Nigerians, has often played an important role in driving public sentiments and conversations in the country. Japheth JJ Omojua, a Nigerian writer and social commentator with over 1 million followers on Twitter, joins me from Abuja to talk about the reaction by Nigerians and the impact it will have around the country.
I think it's been coming. As at 6-7 years ago, we've been battling different forms of attempts at gagging social media. Some of those laws were actually outrightly anti-social media laws. Some of them were hidden inside other laws that did not outrightly mention the word social media, like frivolous abuse and other petition, for instance. And after that, I think it came to a head in 2020 when social media proved very, very influential during the NSAS movement in the latter part of 2020. And the government did pay extra attention to the power of social media and what people are able to do with it. Then another turning point definitely was when 3 days ago, Twitter deleted President Buhari's tweet, and the government didn't like that at all. And I don't think, I was shocked, really. I'm still kind of shocked. But nobody would be surprised that after that, that the action of suspending Twitter in Nigeria and the fact that Twitter deleted the president's tweet is not difficult to see a correlational and causative effect for both actions. Did so you, in a nutshell, basically, that's what happened.
Okay, so Twitter deleted President Buhari's tweet that they considered inflammatory. Did you see that happening? Do you think this is, an overreaction on their part?
I don't even want to say Twitter considered it inflammatory. I think it was lots of Nigerians primarily that kept reporting the tweet for being inflammatory, for projecting genocide on account of the reference that the president had made to the Biafra war and the language of who deal with it in the language that you understand. Now, there was a video where the tweet was picked out from, actually. The tweet was actually a transcription. But unfortunately for the president, the text came out before the video. So in the video, there was a clear delineation between the reference to Biafra and the president's intention to deal with today's insurgents. But the text does not do that separation. So taking on account of itself, which of course you would do because there was no video in the first place, you would think that what the hell is going on here? So people reported the tweet, and Twitter, as you would know, is no respecter of your position, did what Twitter would do in a situation like that. They removed the tweet. Interestingly, the other parts of the thread were left, but this particular part of the thread that was quite problematic was removed.
Now, is Buhari a prolific Twitter user himself?
I don't think Buhari has ever tweeted himself before, maybe except for he performed 3 tweets before during the elections. I think his page is 100% being managed by his team. I don't think Buhari tweets by himself. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I may be wrong, but I don't think so.
And how popular is Twitter in Nigeria?
Extremely popular, massively popular. Twitter is massively popular. Twitter may not win you elections, but it affects your perception as a public servant. Twitter doesn't have as many people as Facebook in Nigeria, but the opinions that get shared on Twitter, the messages, the stories that fly from Twitter, they go into other platforms, including Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, and eventually even to the conventional media space, radio, right, and TV. So Twitter is such a powerful platform. And as you can see, the Twitter ban is eventually every news network. It's the biggest conversation in Nigeria as we speak, even though there are far more important issues. I'm not saying that this is not an important issue, but with hundreds of people being kidnapped and people being killed, you would agree with me that ordinarily this should be far more important, without saying that this particular issue is not important.
And what has been the reaction around the country so far?
I mean, it's been shock, it's been disappointment, it's been a lot of anger, it's been a lot of people, by the way, I should also say a lot of people castigating people for voting Buhari in the first place. So there's been a lot of, I told you so, and blah, blah, blah. You know, whether you agree with what is being done, this is actually what has happened. I have been on the receiving end of that myself, even though my support was in 2015, 6 years ago. A democratic right, by the way, But I've been called names, all sort of names today, just on account of, you know, making that choice. So there's been a lot of that. There's also been a lot of genuine, you know, smart strategic conversation in terms of how the government should better deal with issues like this. It could have directly engaged Twitter on this matter without suspending the platform, because in suspending the platform, you've removed your own people from the platform. You've affected their way, directly and indirectly, their way to earning their livelihood and resource. Twitter is used for loads of things in Nigeria. It is for emergency. The NCDC that communicates COVID numbers was not able to communicate that. A lot of people use Twitter to raise money for health reasons. There's a lot of people that use Twitter to raise money for school fees. Lots of people use Twitter directly for their businesses. The banks cannot tweet, for instance. Other organizations, corporates, public, private, cannot tweet. So it's an entire shutdown of more or less a market space.
That was Japheth Jeje Omojua, a Nigerian writer and social commentator. I reached him in Abuja. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Africa has an increasing number of foodborne diseases brought about by contaminated food consumed in most parts of the continent. This is according to World Health Organization that says foodborne pathogens are responsible for at least 137,000 deaths and 91 million acute illnesses in Africa every year, mostly affecting children younger than the age of 5. Maureen Ojambo has more on this story.
At least 600 million cases of foodborne illnesses annually are as a result of unsafe food. This is a threat to human health and economies, mostly affecting vulnerable and marginalized people, as well as population affected by conflict and migrants in Kenya. The government is grappling to contain toxic food, especially those imported from abroad. Claire Nasike, a food campaigner at Greenpeace Africa, said that most of the food consumed in Kenya is not safe.
Food consumed in Kenya is not safe for consumption, and this is owed to the various cases of food contamination by aflatoxins, pesticides, and other pathogens that have been found in the food that is currently consumed by Kenyans.
Nasike says the Kenyan government should ban toxic pesticides used in food production to save the health of its citizens.
Greenpeace Africa has been pushing the Kenyan government through advocacy to ban toxic pesticides that are used in food production, also to formulate policies that support sustainable farming practices such as ecological farming.
At least 420,000 people around the world die every year after eating contaminated food, and children under the age of 5 years carry 40% of foodborne disease burden, with 125,000 deaths every year. Chemical companies in Kenya are blamed for the increased foodborne diseases. Emmanuel Atamba, a researcher and policy analyst at Route to Food Kenya, said that the demand for food has led to toxic food production.
Today is a very important day, World Food Safety Day. Food safety has been one of the key issues or subjects that we have been discussing at Route to Food because of the issues that, of course, coming with the increasing need to produce food. You see that, you know, the system is trying to adjust towards that. And there are a lot of food safety issues that come with that, especially when you're talking about agricultural products.
Atamba says most Kenyans consume food they cannot tell if it's safe or not, and that for food safety to be taken care of, there must be a strong regulator.
Most of the people are consuming food which we cannot tell, or they cannot tell whether it's safe or not. Some of the key food safety issues, of one of them is the pesticide use. Really, using Kenya as an example, particularly the level of pesticide use is quite high. There's a lot of misuse happening. People are exposed to very deadly chemicals because they consume them at the time when the chemical has not degraded.
In a research conducted last year by the University of Nairobi, Department of Public Health noted that pesticides were influencing structural birth effects among children in Kiambu County, a region in Kenya that mainly practices agriculture. With the 2021 theme being Safe Food Now for a Healthy Tomorrow, Greenpeace Africa in Kenya has noted that the ongoing desert locust control has threatened food safety in the country through the use of harmful pesticides that have disrupted pollination and contaminated the process of honey production in some regions. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sports with the Confederation of African Football postponing the 2021 African Cup of Nations final draw. The draw was scheduled for June 25th in Yaounde, the capital of the tournament's host country. But on Sunday, CAF said the postponement was due to logistical reasons related to the COVID-19 pandemic, and a new date will be announced in due course. Staying with football news, several African countries will be involved in international friendlies on Tuesday. Benin Republic will face Zambia. Cameroon will trade tackle with Nigeria in Austria. Morocco will square it out with Ghana, while Senegal will trade tackle with Cape Verde. In Nigeria, Amaju Pinnick, the president of the Nigerian Football Federation, has disclosed that the Nigerian Football Federation is doing everything possible to pay the men's national football team, the Super Eagles, and their coaches. Mr. Pinnick revealed that the football house is currently struggling to meet its financial obligations, no thanks to the current pandemic, which has affected principal sponsors. There are reports that the Super Eagles players are yet to receive bonuses for the just-concluded African Cup of Nations qualifiers, while the Genaro-led technical crew are also owed up to 7 months' salaries. Elsewhere in West Africa, Mr. Thomas Dadi Brima has been elected as the new president of the Sierra Leone Football Association. Mr. Brima succeeds Aisha Johnson after securing a total of 31 votes from the polls to defeat his opponent, Sadiq Dean Yakor, who pulled 26 votes to begin his four-year term. In athletics, Victor Kipchirchir and Mercy Kipchumba are the new champions of the Eldoret City Marathon in Kenya. The Eldoret Marathon is Africa's highest-paying marathon, with well over $30,000 being paid as prize money each for the winner of the men and women's 42-kilometers race. The third edition of the annual race was held in Eldoret, within Gushu County, on Sunday after many interruptions owing to the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. In the men's category, Victor Kipchirchir emerged victorious after clocking 2 hours, 8 minutes, 56 seconds, with Leonard Langat and Emmanuel Barr finishing second and third respectively. In the women's category, Mercy Kichumba won the race in 2 hours, 28 minutes, 10 seconds. And finally, in basketball news, Nigerian national men's basketball coach Mike Brown has confirmed that he may be forced to pick 2 different teams in the coming 2 months, as Olympics and Afrobasket tournament are within 2 weeks of each other. The Afrobasket tournament starts in Rwanda on August 24th, 2 weeks after the Olympics ends in early August in Tokyo, which will trigger an NBA rule prohibiting Nigeria's players from too much international game time. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a great week ahead. And that's it for this Monday, June the 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English Africa Service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good week ahead, Africa.
Africa Weekend Show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 50.